All right, I'm going to talk about some work that I've been doing with Doug Hamilton at the University of Maryland on the obliquities, or the tilts, of the giant planets Jupiter and Saturn. Now, this first table here shows planetary obliquities. I've omitted Venus and Mercury because they're tidally despun, so we don't know what the original obliquities were. And right away, you notice that there's a great variety of obliquities, but Jupiter's obliquity is quite small. Now, the obliquities of the solid objects very plausibly could simply be a result of the accretion process, which is stochastic, tends to randomize obliquities. This could also be true of Uranus and Neptune, although we have heard at this conference that there's an emerging idea that these objects actually accreted mostly small objects, in which case then these obliquities themselves would be something that needs to be explained. But Jupiter and Saturn, we think, are primarily, most of their mass comes from the hydrodynamic inflow. So even if their obliquity, even if their cores had sizable obliquities, it tends to be overwhelmed by the gas content. We see no reason a priori that there would be an in-plane angular momentum for this gas content. So one would naturally expect that the obliquities of both these objects could be very small, but that's not the case. One of them is, but one of them isn't. So our first objective in this study was to try to understand why there's this difference. And its connection, for instance, to planet formation is that, you know, do we have something very wrong with our ideas about giant planet formation? Because, as I said, this seems to be an unexpectedly large obliquity. Or is there some other reason, perhaps post-accretional, that can account for this? So we were looking for that. And the other objective of this study was to examine Jupiter, because if we find a plausible way to account for Saturn's obliquity, then we have to explain why it didn't happen to Jupiter, which may tell us something about timing of events or various processes in the early solar system. So we're hoping we can find some additional constraints on early solar system models using that. I'll point out that the obliquities of the cores could be anything, but they're simply not enough material there to account for Saturn's obliquity. You could perhaps have a residual obliquity, a small obliquity from a core that originally had a very large obliquity, maybe account for Jupiter, but not for Saturn. All right. Our mechanism of choice is one we know causes large obliquity changes, which are coupling between the spin and orbit motions through what's called a secular spin-orbit resonance. This is a one-to-one commensurability between the spin axis precession rate of the planet and its orbit precession rate. Or, more specifically, maybe a term in its orbital precession, because the precessions are not uniform. They tend to have lots of components to it. They're very similar mathematically to orbit secular resonances that Renu Malhotra was talking about yesterday, and they have some similar-looking phase-based structures and so forth. Now, these are the three principal terms that we are worried about in the Laplace-Lagrange solution of secular variations in the inclinations. They're historically labeled the new 1.6, 1.7, 1.8, but physically, the new 1.6 is a roughly 50,000-year co-precession of Saturn and Jupiter. These are the amplitudes here, so these can get fairly large, maybe on the order of a degree. The two different colors are two different planets. But the other two are due to perturbations from Uranus and Neptune, respectively, on Jupiter and Saturn. This is about 500,000. This is about 500,000 years. This is about 2 million-year periods for these terms. The dots here are the spin axis precession rates of Jupiter and Saturn in the case of a very low obliquity. The obliquity can change the spin axis precession rate a little bit, and that turns out to be very key to us. But in the limit of a very small obliquity, so this cosine theta term is of order unity, this gives the values that we calculate for the spin axis precession rates, and you can see that they're suspiciously close to these two terms, which is what keyed us into this problem initially. This is a very odd near match. Now, we're going to start with Saturn, explain how we think the obliquity of Saturn originates. To do this, I'm going to take you on a quick tutorial of second or spin orbit resonances, so you can get a sense of how this works. Right, now if you have a spin axis S, if these are all unit vectors, processing around a fixed orbit normal N, this is the very simple precession equation that yields uniform spin axis precession at a constant obliquity and at a constant rate. The proportionality constant here in the front, which is referred to as the precessional constant, involves what the J2 of the planet is, what its effective quadrupole field is, so how much torque you can exert on it. And it also this type of torque is divided by the spin axis in the planet that you have to drag around. So it also involves the moment of inertia of the planet, its spin rate, and so forth. And I'll show a formula for this pretty soon. So this is a very simple uniform precessional motion that's adequate for many cases. But in our case, we also are moving the orbit itself. So N is not fixed. So we're going to process N. So now the spin axis is trying to move around N, but N is also trying to move. So you have to take both into account. Now the simplest way mathematically to do this is simply transfer to a rotating frame in which you can get the orbit plane fixed again. But this is not an inertial frame now, so you have to pick up an additional term. And this G is what we're going to refer to as the orbit plane regression frequency. Okay, so it's generally a negative number. This is a very well-studied problem. There's a sort of pioneering paper by Giuseppe Colombo in 1966 who analyzed this system very thoroughly. This is a figure from him. And he showed that this has an integral. It's a Hamiltonian of the motion. A Hamiltonian can be represented by parabola. And the intersection of these parabola, these are cylindrical parabola, so they come out of the screen. The intersection of these parabola with the unit sphere gives the trace of the trajectories of the spin axis. Okay, so this is the front view, if you want to call this the front. This is the back view. Moving the vertex of the parabola along is changing values of the Hamiltonian. The location of the axis of the parabola depends on the ratio of these two frequencies, alpha over g. The bigger alpha is, the lower the axis is. Okay, smaller alpha is, the axis goes up. Now, it turns out that in the most general case, there are four values of the vertice, or the vertex, at which the parabola is just tangent to the unit sphere. So in that case, the trajectory degenerates to a point. These are called Cassini states. And there are generally four of them. The customary labeling, which was, I think, introduced by Stan Peel, is state one, which is this one right here. State two is over here. That's this one. State three is a retrograde state. And state four is here. Now notice that the first three are stable states in the sense that the spin axis is slightly offset from it. It tends to circulate that state. But state four is on a separatrix. So it's an unstable state. Divides the unit sphere into the three domains, each containing one of the stable states. I now want to ask the question, what happens if, through some process or processes, we are able to change the ratio of alpha over the frequency? And let's first imagine that we're starting with an alpha over g, which puts us over here, and we form the planet with a small obliquity. And now we change alpha in such a way as to move us in this direction. If you do it slowly enough, the spin axis will continue to process around state one, which is where it's starting. And the area that it has around it is an adiabatic invariance. So it tries to track the position of state one. But the position of state one begins to rotate away from the orbit normal, which is the z-axis here. At the same time, the state four begins to rotate towards it, and eventually they merge. What's happened is that the parabola axis has simply popped up above the unit sphere, and you can't get those tangencies anymore. But the spin axis finds itself here, suddenly has no stable state to circulate except for state 2, so it must start oscillating around state 2. If we continue the process, state 2 will eventually roll up towards the orbit normal again, but now you're left with a finite obliquity when originally you started with almost nothing. So this is what we call passage through resonance in the non-captured direction, and it sort of results in a kick in the obliquity. Now, if you go in the opposite direction, you don't have this same sort of irreversible kick, because if you start over here with a low obliquity and you do something to change the ratio, moves us over in the other direction, state 2 never becomes unstable. So you could just follow state 2 up to very high values. Well, this is the current obliquity of Saturn. Now, we don't know exactly what alpha over g is, because it turns out the most uncertain thing is the moment of inertia of Saturn. But we think it's somewhere around in here. So this led us to wonder whether it could actually be in state 2. So we check this by putting Saturn on the unit sphere. Now, this is the unit sphere again, but we're looking down now along the orbit normal, looking on the top of it. So this is that separatrix that I was talking about before that has state 4 in it. And state 2 is actually inside the separatrix. And when we put Saturn down, it's very easy to put Saturn in a position such that it is captured inside this. Okay, you only need a moment of inertia of 0.223, and that's very close to estimates based on interior models. So we propose this is in fact the case, that Saturn is currently trapped in this resonance with Neptune, and that it originally formed with a much smaller obliquity and was driven to this state during evolution of the solar system. Now, what sort of evolution could account for this? Well, our favorite is the possibility of a decreasing mass in the Kuiper Belt, or at least changes in the outer part of the solar system. Because what they do is they change G, okay? They decrease G. And decreasing G is the same as running us over in this direction. So as the Kuiper Belt decreases, the precession rate of Neptune starts to drop. It engages Saturn at the resonance and drags Saturn over, and its current value is simply the end value when the Kuiper Belt is primarily exhausted.
The vibration of Neptune has the same effect.
It has the same effect. It's just more difficult to model, but we are considering that too. All right. So here's a numerical experiment testing this. In this case, we're not using just uniform precession of the orbit. This time, we're using an orbital theory developed by Bretignon, together with the Franco or Francou or Francois. So 1992. There are hundreds of terms in this theory, but sure enough, it's like tuning a radio. Saturn picks out this term as we begin to scan it, and very quickly rolls over. We drop the value of the frequency of the new 1-8 according to a very simple slow depletion model of the Kuiper Belt, and we asymptote to a value very similar to what we see. However, it's missing something, and it's missing the fact that the spin axis is not actually in state 2; it's offset. So there must be some libration of Saturn around state 2. So how do we get that?
Bill,
yeah.
Is there a requirement in the time scale of
these changes? Yes, that's exactly what I'm going to talk about. All right, so we can think of a number of different ways to account for this libration. One of the possibilities is that there was a pre-existing obliquity, that it's captured, but it's captured with an obliquity that it already has, which is much smaller, but sufficient to cause a libration. That pre-existing obliquity, one interesting possibility, it's actually caused by an earlier pass through the resonance during the contraction of Saturn. In other words, if Saturn actually starts over here, goes through the resonance at a rate sufficient to excite a small obliquity during Saturn's contraction, but the contraction slows down, and so eventually, if the Kuiper Belt erosion becomes more important, you can actually reverse, go through the resonance a second time, and produce these librations. Another possibility is what Doug was alluding to, and that is that the capture is somewhat non-adiabatic. That is, that you capture the rate at which you're eroding the Kuiper Belt is comparable to the rate of the libration of the spin axis, which is about 80 million years. So another possibility is that these two rates were close enough that you generate, and we've done numerical experiments of that too. I don't happen to have a slide here, but we can also produce results very similar to this. Of course, we can't rule out a small impact that could have occurred, because it doesn't need much of an impact to actually produce this area inside the separatrix is much smaller than the area inside the entire spin axis of obliquity itself. Or we also cannot rule out some pre-existing fossil obliquity from a core. So there are a number of different ways that this could be done. So this is our fix for Saturn, and it suggests that Saturn did not form with a large obliquity. There's nothing amiss with our formation models. It could have formed with an obliquity as small as zero and still wound up with what we have now just through the rearrangements of the outer solar system and this resonance capture. All right, now let's move on to the other object, Jupiter. And the hope here is that by comparing these two cases, we can learn some additional things about the early solar system, or at least constrain the possibilities. Again, here's that plot I showed earlier. Jupiter is near the new 1-7, that's the Uranus resonance, just as Saturn is with the new 1-8, but notice that it's on the opposite side. So in fact, Jupiter is on this side of the resonance at present with a very small obliquity. But nonetheless, this obliquity does become comparable to the obliquity of state 2 at a value of alpha over g, which is within the range of the uncertainty that we have because of the uncertainty of the moment of inertia of Jupiter. So again, we want to check to see where the spin axis of Jupiter is compared to state 2. So we're going to look down on the unit sphere again, although this time, because all the obliquities are so small, I can't draw in the whole unit sphere, and I also am not drawing in any of the trajectories, but this is the orbit normal at origin. This is the invariable plane normal, which is on the x-axis by definition, the way we construct this coordinate system. And state 2 should also lie along here. If you use the nominal value of 0.26 for state 2, it would be here. And so where is Jupiter? Jupiter is here. It's almost exactly coplanar with N and K. The probability of finding Jupiter here, if this is state 2 and Jupiter is actually precessing around state 2, is extremely small. So we think that state 2 is in fact over here, much closer to the current spin axis. And this gives us a very tight constraint on the moment of inertia of Jupiter. You need the precession rate of Jupiter to get the moment of inertia, combine it with J2. But another way to do it is to find something that's a consequence of the precession rate of Jupiter. And that's essentially what we're doing. If we assume that state 2 is very near this, we are, in a sense, fixing the precession rate of Jupiter. And then we can solve for the moment of inertia. The moment of inertia is somewhat lower than published values, but we've talked to people that do these things, and they say they're really not confident to more than 10%. Yeah. That's been figured in. That's all in here. All right, so, yeah.
Does this provide constraints on its Jovian core if it does have this lower moment of inertia?
Well, I would think it would. But I'm not that familiar with the interior models, but it's one of the things we want to look at. This is, we've just discovered this recently, so we're starting to talk to people that are doing this. But we're hoping that it does say something like that. And I would say we want to actually lower moment of inertia. So, it seems to be argue in that direction.
But the problem there is that we still don't know the equation state hydrogen well enough. And of course, the heavy elements may not are just in a core. Uh-huh. Have some uncertain mix in the material above the core. And even the amount of helium that may have rained out will have an effect. So there's no one-to-one correspondence between the moment of inertia and the size of the core.
Okay, now, if that's true, if, in fact, state 2 is very near this current spin axis of Jupiter, then that also tells us that most of the current 3-degree obliquity of Jupiter is, in fact, forced. It's due to Uranus. It's not a free obliquity. So the free obliquity of Jupiter may actually be much lower than that. Now, if it is much lower than that, then there are some other sort of corollaries of this. Jupiter really couldn't suffer much of an impact after it achieved this state, because it would be very easy to generate obliquities on the order of a few tenths of a degree. Also, it can't have much of a signature of a pre-existing core with a large obliquity. Now, the core could have been spinning more slowly, or it could have not had a large obliquity. So there's parameter space there. But the most interesting from the point of view of what we started out to do was that it also argues that it does not pick up an obliquity going through any of the resonances that it plausibly could have gone through, particularly the Uranus one, and also the new 1-6. And I'll get into a moment why we think that's a concern. But first, let's talk about the new 1-7. We've seen that Jupiter is very near it. I talked about the fact if you go through the resonance in the non-captured direction, you get this kick in the obliquity. We can calculate the size of that kick very easily. This shows the kick you would get going through these resonances arbitrarily slowly as a function of the amplitude of the resonance. These are the obliquities that you generate, and they are enormous compared to the amplitude of the term causing them. And in particular, again, I'm using color code, for Jupiter going through the new 1-7 in the non-captured direction, you get an obliquity of almost 14 degrees. This is, you know, way too large. If it actually goes through the new 1-6 at some point in its path, of course, it's even larger than that. And we can't rely on maybe picking up an obliquity and then damping it out, because the fact that Saturn is librating right now implies that there's not strong damping mechanisms on the obliquity, although that, I think there is work that needs to be done on that. But so instead, we have to look some way to short-circuit this process. And of course, the first way to look at is to not go through the resonance slowly. And sure enough, if you go through the resonance at a finite speed, you begin to see a drop in the generated obliquity. It tends to be proportional to 1 over the square root of the scan rate. So what we do is we define a sort of what we call resonance passage time, which is the frequency of the resonance divided by the rate of change. In this case, imagine it's a rate of change of alpha, maybe due to the contraction of Jupiter, for instance, which tends to drive alpha down. And we can calculate what value we would need to go, what time scale we would need to go through the resonance as a function of the target obliquity we want to produce. And it has the ratio of the target obliquity over the amplitude. That's a squared dependence. And also, of course, the period of the term itself. So here are the curves for the obliquity as a function of time scale for the new 1-6, new 1-7. For the new 1-7, let's concentrate on that one first. It's about 430,000-year time scale. And to produce a 1 degree obliquity, you need to go through this resonance on a time scale of about 5 million years. Now, if the entire 3 degree obliquity of Jupiter were free obliquity, like we originally thought it would be, then actually this would be about an order of magnitude larger than that. And you know, you could do that with just contraction of Jupiter. That's not too bad. You could generate that small of an obliquity. But if in fact the obliquity is much smaller than that, then it's hopeless to try to go through the new 1-7 while you're contracting without generating an obliquity. So how do we avoid this? Well, this may say something about the timing of events in the solar system, because after all, the new 1-7 only exists if Uranus exists. And so one possibility is that Jupiter forms early enough that it is able to contract from a state over here to a state over here before Uranus actually gets large enough to become a strong enough perturber. And then also Uranus may form at a higher precession rate than it has now because of the excess material outside of it that's going to presumably form Neptune and be the remnant of the Kuiper belt.
What does that mean?
And also migration.
What does that mean?
What does what mean?
You said, where Jupiter can contract from state over here.
Oh.
What is that?
Oh, maybe 50%, something like that. I mean, it's...
Jupiter, you know,
yeah. It's all in that range. Okay, so that's why you have fairly long time sales for contraction. And so if, in fact, the system forms on this side of the resonance, simply because when Jupiter was moving across earlier, Uranus was not in place, then you can simply approach its current position, which we think is right here, where this intersection, by depleting the Kuiper belt. Okay.
Bill, when you talk about...
I only have 5 minutes, Jack, so...
your question time, not yet. When you're talking about Jupiter contracting, are you assuming homologous contraction, or it's just the envelope?
Well, this is at the very, very end, okay? So Jupiter is only slightly larger than it is now. Okay, so we're not talking about earlier when it's filling a good part of its hill sphere.
Right, but I mean, even when it's two Jupiter radii, the inner part of Jupiter is only slightly bigger than it is now, whereas the outer part is...
Yeah, and we're not modeling this, but it probably should be done. I mean, it may give a slightly different answer what the relative radii are. Okay, so I also point out, as just sort of an aside, that it really could go through the resonance as long as its first passage is in the capture direction. So if the sort of competition between the slow decrease of Uranus's precession rate and the slow decrease of alpha is such that these two invert, you could actually wind up over here in a somewhat Saturn-like position and then come back down to its current position. And that's okay, because you don't pick up this kick. As long as you go through the resonance first in the capture direction, then you can go back through it and not suffer this kind of a kick. We don't necessarily advocate that, but it's an amusing possibility that at some time Jupiter actually had a larger obliquity. It also supports the idea, of course, that Uranus formed after Jupiter had contracted, and that time scale is comparable to the lifetime of the solar nebula. So it supports the idea that Jupiter formed after much of the solar nebula was depleted, which we already think is probably true for other reasons. And of course, it supports the idea of a larger Kuiper belt.
Doesn't all this assume that the nebula is not there, because your secular frequencies are all very different?
That's right. It assumes that most of the nebula is, yeah, I'm going to talk about that in just a second. All right, now I want to talk about the new 1-6. The new 1-6, if you remember, was much, much further away. It's currently over here at about 43,000 degrees, about a factor of 10 faster than the precession rate of Jupiter. Is it plausible the precession rate of Jupiter could have ever been that high? Well, I think it is, because the current precession rate of Jupiter is really due mostly to the Galilean satellites. There's the solar torque on the Galilean satellites exceeds the direct solar torque on the planet by a factor of 3. So it's really the satellites that are determining the precession rate of Jupiter, and it follows that if you also had a precursor disk, an accretion disk from which the satellites were forming, that could further increase the precession rate of Jupiter. You have to be careful when you do this problem, because the disk can warp, so we take that into account. But this is the general equation for this precessional constant alpha. It contains Jupiter's J2, but it also contains the effective J2 of the satellites, and we're adding an effective J2 of the disk. But we're also including this sort of warp, where psi is the angle of the disk to the orbit normal, and theta is the obliquity. And this runs from unity all the way to zero as you move out of the disk. Turns out it's mostly the disk that's inside what we call the warp distance that contributes to the precession rate. This is a figure actually for Saturn from an earlier paper, but Jupiter is the same kind of concept. We also have to include the angular momentum in the satellites and the disk. But if we do that and calculate the precession rate of Jupiter, or actually in this case it's the time scale, the precession time scale of Jupiter, here it is up here, very near the new 1-7, but we find that in fact it doesn't take a whole lot of material in this disk to actually make the precession rate on the other side of the new 1-6, which puts us in danger again. This parameter here is the mass of the disk inside this warp distance, just a convenient measure of this. And so when this is on the order of just the satellite mass alone, you're already very near the new 1-6. We expect it probably could be higher than that, certainly at various times in the history of Jupiter when it's forming. It's quite plausible that it had precession frequencies or precession rates that are down in here on a few thousand years. So then, as you lose this disk, you're going to go through the new 1/6, and again, we have to explain how to avoid that. Well, if the entire obliquity, again, if the entire obliquity of Jupiter could be used as a free obliquity, we could do that. We could account for this by simply viscous dissipation of the disk. Reasonable values of the viscosity parameter can remove the disk or make this resonance passage time scale just about right to produce the 3-degree obliquity, which is, you know, originally what we expected. But now, of course, if we don't have a 3-degree obliquity, this is a hopeless problem again. You can't get through this resonance fast enough to avoid producing an obliquity. Now, maybe there's damping mechanisms we're not aware of at that time, and that's a possibility. But another way to do this is to see if we can avoid this resonance the same way we tried to avoid the new 1/7. So how could we do this one? Well, you can't do it very well with the timing issue. We formed Uranus late, but we know Saturn has to form while the nebula is still there. So we can't delay its formation from Jupiter too much. But on the other hand, the nebula is still there. So we can take the account, the effect of the nebula on the precession of Jupiter. It turns out that if the nebula is there, it precesses Jupiter much faster than Saturn does. And in fact, it can be precessing on the time scale of a few thousand years. Whereas if you increase the mass of the disk around Jupiter itself to the point where it's the dominant term, there's a limit to alpha, which is also on the order of a couple thousand years. So our suggestion is that this, in fact, was on the other side of this one during the early events of the solar system, and we have a situation like this. Yes, Jupiter starts down here on the other side of the present new 1/6, but the present new 1/6 is an end product of the precession rate of Jupiter, which when the nebula was in place is actually much lower. And therefore, while the nebula is in place, if we can lose the disk and get on the other side of the current position of the new 1/6, then as the nebula is dissipated, we can safely put the new 1/6 in its current position and not generate the obliquity. So this is one way to do it. Unfortunately, it may not be unique, so it's mostly a constraint. But these are, I think, interesting constraints on what happens in the early solar system that were unappreciated before, that you do need to sort of check to see what you're doing to the spin axis of these planets while you're trying to do other things in the early solar system. Okay, I'll stop there.
Thank you for this clear presentation of a complicated process. So are there questions? Stu?
Well, the moment of inertia of Saturn, at least, supposedly has evolved over time, probably due to separation of helium. Could this have any effect, or is that on its libration that we now see, or is that too slow a process?
Well, it will change the position of state 2. But once you're captured into that resonance, Saturn would simply follow it. Okay, as long as that process occurred, you know, slow compared to the libration time, which is 80 million years, then it won't matter. It'll just wind up where it is now anyway. Mm-hmm. You can have a history like that without changing the end product much.
Okay, while I've got the mic, let me ask if you have any insights about the obliquities of Uranus and Neptune.
We're thinking about it. Certainly, if there's a scenario like Yoram was talking about, where you don't have large impacts, then they become an outstanding problem as to why these obliquities are there. And, you know, it's worth looking at these early solar system frequencies when the nebula is in place to see whether you can do something to them. So we're thinking about it.
Other questions? No.
He's fighting me.
No, it's more of a
comment. It's impossible.
My cross section is a lot bigger than your cross section. Excuse me?
What did you
say? Yeah, I guess I can fold off.
Then it's close.
Yeah, I hide behind my wife that way a lot. Getting back to the issue of migration, after all, like I said on Monday,
right.
To a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. In the pre-migrated solar system, if what we are thinking is right, the new one 6 is going to be a lot different because yeah. Jupiter and Saturn are going to be significantly closer to
right,
one.
Right.
And that could help solve this problem yeah. with the new 1-6 crossing.
Other questions? So then I have one for Uranus and Neptune. That what you said that when there is a massive disk, Kuiper belt, whatever, G17, G18 are faster. Okay. But in addition to those, you have also probably a G19, which is a frequency induced by the disk, which is
yes.
not a line, it's
yes.
a broad peak.
Yes.
That's much slower. So
yes.
that one could be resonant with the spin precession rate of Uranus.
That's one of the ideas we're looking at.
Okay.
Very good, though.
Other comments, questions? We are ahead of time. Okay, well. Thanks, Bill.
Sure.
So we move. Yeah.